Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin.
With guest co-hosts...
Alpha Shard.
Troy Goodfellow.
They had to do PAX East right after we recorded the last Polycast episode.
Thanks, guys.
Hello there, I'm Troy Goodfellow, and this is episode 170, and it's been a very, very long time since I've been on the show. So I'm very happy to have with me some very intelligent people to help me walk through the things I forgot about civilization. We have the Mian Team.
All my neighbors have going concerns.
Imagine.
Inmates are running the asylum.
Makalua.
More coffee still needed.
And Alpha Shard.
You cannot have my land.
Yes, it's a great pleasure to be here. Dan's been trying to get me on the show for the last few months. It's been a few years since I've been on. But finally, I found time in my schedule, and Dan scoots off to safety. He expects a disaster, I suspect. Well, we'll try to give him what he expects. So I guess we should just jump right in, I suppose, with the news.
Second expansion pack for Sid Meier's Civilization V, the second by lead designer Ed Beach, who brought you the fabulous Gods and Kings. We are still in the middle of production, so if you happen to notice any bugs, just ignore them, and don't tweet about them till after the show's over.
The big news for Civilization is the Penny Arcade Expo announcements, or what they showed at Penny Arcade Expo. I was fortunate enough to be at PAX East this year. I was on a couple of panels, including one on turn-based strategy games, and I had a chance to attend the Firaxis panel, which was half XCOM, half Civ 5. We'll let the alien killers have their own podcast sometime later. So we're going to focus on the Civ 5 news. So anything people want to start with, or their reactions to what was revealed, what was talked about in Dennis's presentation?
I think on the Sunday one, we were talking about Brazil having a golden age called the Carnival, and it all depends on their happiness. He didn't say like how it would trigger. Like, if you're just in a happy state, does it just happen all the time? Or is there, like, you have to have a certain amount of happy people so that way you don't totally abuse this mechanic? I hope that there's some sort of cap to keep it from being abused. But it did sound like a really good way to get a late-game culture victory if you hadn't been building up to it at that point.
From looking at the forums, it seems that they've also let out the rest of the details on Brazil and that fact that Brazil seems to be tourism heavy, tourism being the new cultural offense related yield for the new culture victory condition. So it does look like Brazil will be heavily involved in the culture game now.
Did they go into revealing more details about Assyria's royal library? Because I know also at PAX East, they were talking about that being a unique building for Assyria, where he can just have this unique library. So I guess he's going to be a science civ.
I don't know if they actually fully revealed it, so I'm not going to speculate.
I hope it's not one of those culture libraries where that's all it does, and it doesn't really do it that well.
Yeah, I think most we know it's called the Royal Library. I'll go with that. But Assyria is meant to be a domination technology civ combination. They have a siege tower as well as a unique ability that gives them, according to the forums, get a technology from when you take over somebody's city.
That's like the old, that's going to be abused.
Civ 2 style.
Yeah.
From what I remember, it is limited to what the other civ has.
And you only do it once per city, from what I've been reading. And, you know, it's kind of nice to have that kind of mechanic back for one of the civs, because you can't trade text like you used to. There's really no way to, except for the scientific agreement thing. There's no way to have that cultural exchange of knowledge or that military section, which is good. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It was one of the good things with Civilization V. It forced you to do things kind of on your own. But it's nice to have that option for people who want to have the, I'm conquering you and I'm taking your science as well, which which does happen historically in a few instances. And it's certainly worth having the option for players who want to play a militaristic game, but not have always be trailing in tech.
I agree. It's something I really missed from the previous games. I really did.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense to me to not be able to take another Civ's knowledge that it just goes to waste.
It'll be a different playstyle than what we have in-game right now.
Go honor. Only honor. Everything for honor.
We can go back to give me all your tech to not die.
Yeah. As Ekat mentioned, the Mongol scenario actually does have getting free text.
Yeah.
So it's been in the game since the beginning-ish.
Not in the base game, though.
Yeah. But it's been hiding there in the Mongol scenario.
In the free scenario.
Yeah. I know on Sunday we got a great profile view of of Dennis.
They did mention the warriors, the unique unit for Poland, were those winged knights, and that apparently they used the wings to make a whirring noise or a roaring noise when they rode into battle, which, you know, sounds kind of cool, you know, that they got into the culture of that civ.
The power of the Poles are a cavalry civ, and the power of the winged knights is if they win a victory, they will push their opponent back, which gives you the chance to break a line, to stop front and stop that support for frontline units, which is quite a neat power, I think. I guess it's like the retreat power of the Mayan slingers, only now it's something you don't want to happen.
Yeah, force forward.
Yeah, that is good. That's unique. I don't think I've seen that in Civ before.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, so the winged hussar, I'm guessing it's going to be an Incan slinger.
Yeah.
Ekat's keeping an eye on you.
Yeah. All right. Whatever.
But the wing hussar, I'm assuming that they'll be the same as the Austrian hussar in tech location and everything else, since they are both hussars.
You wonder their strength.
Yeah, that I could not tell from my very distant seat. Really does depend when they come in, how quickly you can stop that power from taking place. But they also come with a pasture improvement, which is a super duper pasture improvement. It seems to increase, you know, everything, gold and hammers and experience. I'm not going to say it's overpowered, but it's certainly going to make a priority for Poland to seize as many cows and horses as they can possibly find. This seems to come from quite nice bonuses.
Mm-hmm. And sheep. Very experienced sheep. The Ducal stable as a stable replacement. So you get 15% production and experience for mounted units. So it is limited to mounted units, which obviously is going to give them a nice benefit because, I mean, a lot of people don't tend to use the mounted units because they're very weak on the defense and it takes a lot of experience to make them great on the offense.
Right.
So even just that extra 15% experience, you can easily get up to three promotions right off the mark without wonders. And if you happen to have certain wonders, like Alhambra, that gives you the free rough terrain bonus. You can get into March, and that's where they start becoming very dangerous. And of course, you get the plus one gold in production on pastures. So pastures will be a very nice thing. And if you go religion and get that pantheon to get the extra culture on pastures,
the strong
Poland's heads. Really going to love that pasture. And according to Sifanatics, they do know it is a Lancer replacement. So it's kind of right on that.
Yeah.
Assume it's, you know, in the standard Lancer replacement range.
Yeah, I think Lancers are kind of the unit I never build. They're just stuck in that awkward place on the tree. I'm not a Civ expert. I'm not very good at the higher levels. I'm distracted by other shiny things like early access to Europa Universalis 4. But, you know, there's it helps to do PR. I never quite saw the use of the Lancer, but something that's kind of a really powerful one might let me see what the attraction is in general, though somehow I doubt it.
Ever since Gods and Kings, pikemen have upgraded to lancers.
Yeah.
So they're the anti-mounted. Plus, they have a higher base combat strength than gunpowder units.
Yeah.
They can hit hard fairly well and run away. And they also counter the cavalry, which comes later.
Yeah.
So if there's a bunch of mounted units on the map.
Which is kind of the thing, if there's a bunch of mounted units on the map.
Yeah, exactly.
You have some of them regardless, but this isn't a unit that you would just make, you know, 10 or 20 of normally.
Right. That's not like riflemen or something that's going to be the bulwark of an army, but it might be for Poland.
If you can force other units to withdraw.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Let's just play push you around the map.
Surround and pound.
Well, definitely, because flanking bonuses, they go both ways. So if you can attack somebody and push them back away from being a flank support for another unit, and then you bring in your other standard melee units to go attack it, it won't get the flanking bonuses or the adjacency bonus if they're in honor. So yeah, you can definitely use it as a force multiplier to move things around the map. Or if you like that hill that they're sitting on.
Get off my hill.
Yeah, use the lancers to push them off and then move your own rifle or something like that to go take the hill. And then your units start getting the rough terrain bonuses.
Although you do actually have to win that battle to get the push.
Yeah, so we'll have to see what that actually means, though.
Probably that you do more damage than they do, i.e. minor victory or whatever, at least.
Well, I don't think they've showed it in action. So,
That's what it sounds like. You'd have to at least come away with some kind of victory to get a push.
Yeah.
Which would make sense. It would make the unit more balanced than if you fight at all, you have the option of pushing them backwards.
On Brazil, Scott was talking about the Carnival earlier. I'm just looking at CFC. So there's 50% production of great person points for artists, musicians, and writers, and double tourism while they're in their Carnival.
Ooh, that does sound good.
It's not just a changed name. Actually, they get something useful. Their unique units, which was put out in a Spanish article or something. It's the, let's see if I can pronounce it badly, because it's all they do. The Proconas. It has a special ability of adding to your Golden Ages.
What type of unit is it? Is it, I mean, like mounted or infantry or something
like
that?
It's a World War II era infantry unit.
Okay.
Based on the Brazilian soldiers sent to fight in World War II.
And then it adds to your Golden Age, you said?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so that
is
makes
it
you...
Is it experience or something?
Actually, yeah, my understanding is it wins battles, and those add towards Golden Age points. Brazil can fight and build towards a Golden Age instead of just adding up happy points.
So there you go. You can fight your way into a Golden Age, and then use that Golden Age to super crank your tourism and culture, actually, if Golden Ages are still giving you free culture. Convert the world to your culture via domination.
It's an interesting choice to a Brazilian civ.
Yeah, there's quite a few people who are like, why not Portugal?
Well, Portugal hasn't been ruled out yet, right?
That's true. No. You get six more options. So, you know, you get Portugal, you get Zulu. I don't know.
You have to have Zulu. Come on.
I know.
Canadians. Canadians.
Yeah. Canadians, Australians.
No, Canadians. Sorry. Can't happen. I'm being silly.
And I guess to clean up Brazil, they also have the Brazilian wood camps for their unique tile improvement. They require jungles and get +1 gold on it and +1 culture after acoustics. So instead of trade post spam all those jungles, you get to Brazil wood camp spam all your jungles.
Makes sense.
So yes,
because cutting down the rainforest is totally a great idea.
Well, it didn't say that it actually cut it down.
Slash and burn, Mackie. Slash and burn.
That's your favorite tactic there, Phil.
Yeah, but I don't usually use it on the jungles and forests.
Oh, yeah. Or a civ, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about using that in the woods areas. You use that on cities.
Okay, we've just met a new leader, brand new to the Civ series, Pedro II of Brazil. He's sort of busy doing his paperwork here, so we're not going to bother with him too much. I guess we'll just leave him be and go on with our business. And so what's happened is we're measuring our tourism against all the other civilizations in the game. We have different levels from exotic to popular. And if you can get up to the level called influential with every other civilization in the game, then you've won the culture victory the brand new way.
I did like that the works, they're adding music in there, and you can hear the music pieces when you've made them, and you can add them to your libraries or museums or whatever. So that looks like it'll be a fun little mechanic to work with.
Yeah, I really miss the Wonder movies from Civ 2, and this is a poor replacement.
I know.
But it's something, you know. It's it adds some of the music and some of the culture that Civ's always supposed to represent. So I'm kind of glad they're pushing it in that direction.
Created those extra great works. Our tourism has gone up. We haven't talked a lot about this yet, there are two different slots in the museum so that the museum can hold two different pieces of art. And there's a intricate little sort of mini game within there about trying to set up your museum so they have the right themes.
Oh.
Because you can get bonus culture and tourism. You know, if you try to put together a museum and it has a wildly divergent set of things in it that don't make sense together, it's not going to be as cool to people who all want to come and see, you know, let me go see all the Renaissance artwork. Or...
It looks like pretty much every building that used to generate culture, so your amphitheater, your opera house, and all that line, they've had their culture reduced, plus they have these slots for your great artists, musicians, and writers.
Which, of course, means that all of the other civs that relied heavily on culture, especially something like France, are going to have their powers completely rewritten to take account of the new mechanics.
Yeah, that's a lot of people are expecting that sort of thing. And I'd have to see how the unique buildings for some of these civs will take place. Like the Boudicca's opera house replacement. Will that still be basically just a changed opera house with a little extra happy, or are they going to leave it as, you know, extra culture
yep.
from it? So it'll be interesting to see what they do with the unique varieties of these places, let alone wonders that could possibly be changed.
Yeah.
Because I think we did see in the PAX East demo that there was at least one wonder or the Hermitage or something along that line that had great work slots.
Well, that would make sense. It was an art repository.
Well, there you go. The culture game has definitely changed. It's now more interactive
yeah.
than it used to be, hitting end turn. Here is how I interact with Civ to play culture.
So basically,
end turn,
yeah,
end turn, and end turn.
This is, they're beyond yeah. the sword, basically, to make the end game more interesting and more, better than just hitting end turn, like you said, yeah.
They never made culture more interesting in Civ 4, though.
ECAT actually asked a good question. Monuments, even, for the replacements of culture. That's the question. I don't believe in the PAX East demo they showed a monument. Definitely a setup.
And they were showing pretty much mid and late game stuff, so they wouldn't be revealing a lot about monuments. I mean, the monument is such an early building. I'm not sure it requires a whole lot of tweaking at that point, where your culture is just to push your borders out for the most part. I think, you know, later in the game where you're really interested in getting a cultural victory and culture's just a way to get towards social policies, I think a little bit different. The monuments might not be touched, but they might be. I mean, I know that my sources at Firaxis, you know, say that culture's getting a complete reworking and because it has to. Whether that touches every building in a major way or some in just a minor way, I think we won't really know until it comes out in July.
Well, I mean, they were talking about this tourism versus culture
right.
in a number of articles. So there will still be a need for some basic amount of culture
right.
To fight that tourism in the first place. So some stuff will probably
yes.
have to stay.
So we can go back out to the map now, and it's Peter Bruegel, the Dutch artist, and he'll have him create a great work for us. So he's created this painting. It's the Tower of Babel. It's an actual work done by that artist. And basically all of the great artists, writers, and musicians now in the game are tied to this type of signature work. So if we select a great musician, we can get a similar effect. This is Edvard Grieg. Who doesn't like a good Mountain King, right? You really have to think about with a new trade system, what are your priorities right now? Do you want the gold because that gives you all sorts of flexibility in terms of things you can buy or trade with gold? Or do you want to really just build up your empire? But if you're doing that, then your income's going to go down if you've made a trade-off there. Going to select one of our new city-states that we added for the expansion called Ur, and... that is where we're going to send this trade caravan to right now.
Any thoughts on the trade system? Because I'm kind of wary about that. I'm not sure why. Something about it just seems a bit off to me.
You remember playing Call to Power and getting your routes interrupted all the time?
I hated that. I do not look forward to that at all. I mean, I hope it's not as simple as some barb just randomly stepping onto it, breaking it, and then you having to refix it. I just, we'll have to see.
Yes, two new styles of international trade units, the caravan and the cargo ship. Caravans are unlocked by animal husbandry. They go on land, cargo ships unlocked by sailing, and they go on water. And of course, cargo ship routes apparently are 2 times more gold than land routes.
Cool.
Okay.
So you want cargo ships more often than not.
Once you get to them.
Yeah, especially since it's been confirmed that money has been taken off the actual map.
Yeah, that's going to be strange.
So you're going to want trade routes
to
get your gold. And so, let's see, I can take a caravan, or I can take a cargo ship that gives me twice as much gold as the caravan, and it apparently has bigger range.
That's a tough decision.
Yeah.
It would only be able to trade with coastal cities, though, right? It wouldn't be able to get in land to an internal city.
No.
So, yeah, the caravan would be for the land cities and then the cargo for the coastal.
And the question of the length of the route as well. I mean, if we make more exchanges, I guess, between...
Exactly. There's still definitely more to be found out about that. Apparently they are fire and forget style, or at least that's what it looked like.
I hope it is fire and forget. I hope you don't have to babysit the trade route is what my worry is.
You want to protect them. I mean, that's going to be something. You'll need to have at least troops around to make sure they aren't interrupted. But you won't have to. It's not like you're moving the ships around, which is nice.
Yeah, you're not individually micromanaging them. I mean, and realistically, I mean, yes, they can be destroyed by barbarians or civs that you're at war with, probably give or take, or at least that's what it's saying here. But, you know, if you have your borders spread out, other AIs have their borders spread out, well, then there's not really going to be barbarians around.
Right.
So at some point, that's not really going to be a problem. And, you know, you're not going to have a ship follow the cargo ship.
Privateers will have a whole new thing to do then. They can go hunt down trade routes.
Yeah, it's going to be a way to make the trading game something you can interrupt, which is something quite valuable, I think, if they're tightly connected to gold production. A way to economically starve a country instead of just pillaging, you can just break their trade routes. It would be nice if privateers could, you know, keep their anonymity that they had in Civ 4. That would be kind of cool. So you could raid trade routes and not get caught.
Yeah, so I guess it'll depend on how that plays out. I know people had worries that it was going to interrupt the one unit per tile system with workers and units. So I don't know if we've ever had an answer to the question of does it interfere with it, i.e. can you stack them?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen an answer, but yeah, I hope it doesn't interfere. And that would be really, like you said, you don't want to micromanage these things. So for firing and forgetting, you would hope that you can stack them.
To continue on with it, trade routes are limited. The number possibly affected by wonders, building, social policies, civ uniques, tax, whatever. The greater the distance, the better the reward, as per every trade route in existence. If you go further, you get more stuff out of it. There is basically split into two international trade routes, or where you get gold. Apparently some science, some religion, and tourism also hijack the international trade routes. And domestically, you can trade food between your cities with a granary and production between your cities with a workshop.
I do like that a lot.
Yeah.
Especially the workshop trading, because that little city that you just started to get some resource and you can, and your capital's not really busy with anything, you send all the production there and suddenly, poof, proper city.
Yep.
Yep. I think that's a great step forward. It really does make, instead of waiting for the smaller cities to develop, makes late game settlement, I think, more viable. If something just opens up, you can then just start sending colonists, I guess, to your new town. And also it's good for shifting stuff, for using caravans to build wonders. If you keep sending production, which is, you know, an old Civ 1 and Civ 2 trick, and just stockpile caravans and then send them. Now you can just use the trade routes to send hammers or send production to cities, which I think is, you know, a nice way to focus your empire if you're in a rush to get that wonder up before somebody else's.
Yeah, they mentioned that at the PAX, you know, focusing everything on Giza to build the pyramids. So that's definitely something they wanted us to do or explore.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, especially on, I'd actually said the food side is slightly more important on that one because, you know, as we all know, growth takes time.
Yep.
And it takes a while to get a lot of food going. And eventually, as you grow, the amount of food you need to get to the next population gets higher. And then you need aqueducts and other stuff to speed it up. So if you want that super population capital.
Oh, you can have all the other cities focus their food to the capital. And then you've got a 99-person capital.
Yeah, which can deal with its own production problems. So I can see that being a huge boost for the tall game in the early game. Because extra food early is always big. Extra food later, not so much. You can get them up to certain population side, but the sooner you start growing, the better. And so I think the extra food is definitely going to help tall side civs. Let it grow, and then you switch them all to production when you get to workshops, and then it can super spam out the wonders because it'll have a lot more population than it used to.
As we highlight each of the trade routes there, we get a pop-up that shows us how the game has determined how much gold you're going to get out of that route. In general, the trade route system rewards you for connecting two cities that have very different local resources. So it lists which local resources are found in one city and not another, and the more of those you have, the more gold you'll get out of the trade route. You can also get more gold from your trade route if you build buildings in your city, such as markets and other ones, that will expand your trade capabilities.
Well, I'm Dennis Shirk. I'm the senior producer on the Civ team. A lot of what we do involves the fans. I mean, Ed and the gameplay team do a fantastic job with coming up with the new systems and really just refining everything where we think that there's parts of the game that need to be more exciting and more engaging. But really, when we're all over the forums, we're all over the forums all the times, we see what the fans are asking for because it's what the fans really want. We also have a gameplay feedback group called Frankenstein. That's actually made up of fans from the community, really hardcore fans, fans that really know the game, front, back, left, right, probably somewhat more than we even know our own game. And they've been around since Civ 4 and before, giving our gameplay team constant feedback through development. So as we're putting systems into the game and we need like further refinement, further balance, maybe we need some exploits found, they're there giving us feedback. So the fans' DNA, as much as ours, is written into all of our games.
PAX had talked about Pueblo, but the leader they'd chosen, they ended up not going with the Pueblo because he was just so sacred to the people they talked to. They couldn't get, you know, more information about him. They couldn't get people to speak in the Navajo language for the translation for the leader because he was just so sacred. So they backed down from using the Pueblo as a civilization. That could be it. Or they could have gone for another Native American civilization altogether. There's no shortage of good choices for them, from, you know, mound builders to Apache to Sioux to what have you.
Pope is the one that they wanted to use as the leader. But yes, the Pueblo Council decided that they did not want a game version of him to exist. And Fraxis, unlike some corporations, turned around and said, "We respect your decision. We don't like it, but we'll respect it." Yep. And they were kind enough to tell Civ fans that that happened.
That was good. That was nice.
Of course, what this spawned on the 2K forums was a bunch of forumers mad about it, or upset about it anyways. And
how dare you respect their religious beliefs? Who do you think you are?
Yeah, actually, that was
really?
That was one of those answers. Yeah. Oh. Otherwise, others had taken a different tact and thought that if they send the Pueblo Council a lot of messages asking them to change their mind, that it might do that.
If they spam them, they will change their minds. Guys,
wow.
Like that.
A tactic has always worked in the past. Let's try it.
So yes, it has spawned a grassroots attempt to convince the Pueblo to allow Fraxis to bring it back.
To convince the Pueblo that gamers are just as bad as they've heard they are.
I have seen one or two things that they wrote to send to the Pueblo, and they're trying to be nice.
Of course. You can make a good respectful case that, you know, Fraxis is treating, you know, these cultures with respect. It certainly doesn't hold anyone up for mockery. The fact that throughout Civ 5 and the expansions, they've chosen leaders who are not militaristic warmongers in general. They've chosen people of great stature and culture, and they've had a lot of, you know, women leaders. That's been a conscious choice by Ed Beach and John Schaefer from the very beginning. But Fraxis has already made that case to them.
Yes.
So it's not like, you know, this is something they haven't heard before. This is something very dear to the Pueblo. So I appreciate
that. It's not like they were on
the
fence about this. They've made up their minds, guys.
Yeah. I think it'll be great. I mean, I'd love to have the Pueblo peoples in there. I mean, I like having civilizations that are off the beaten path. When Polynesia was brought in, I was like dancing a jig because I've been pushing for Polynesia since like Civ 3, saying, look, these guys, they traveled the oceans, dude. I mean, this is not a small accomplishment. This is a major. So once Polynesia got to, there's a chance. There's a chance some really, really cool, neat things popping in. And they haven't let me down throughout the expansions. So I think the Pueblo would have been a really, really nice touch. And my friends are really happy about the Poles. I have a couple of Polish friends who are just absolutely thrilled that they get to play Poland.
Yes, and we can stop having the "Where's Poland?" threads. Yeah. And we can stop having the "Why is Austria using Poland's
slurs?" You'll never stop those threads. They'll just take your forms.
A while ago, there was someone asking for Italy, you know, and it's like you're Rome, and there's just people just
sorry,
want
no something. Modern Italy for you.
Okay, so we have a particular troublesome new civilization in our civ world here that we need to teach a lesson to.
Let's do it.
And we're going to go ahead and declare war on Ashurbanipal, one of our new leaders. That's a little bit of a mouthful, but he's actually one of the famous kings of Mesopotamia that led the Assyrian Empire. He was famous for his royal libraries, and that's the leader scene that we have him in. It's in his royal library. And Assyria actually is able to build one of these royal libraries in every city they have. That's their unique building.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We have received mail.
We got mail.
Nice. Yay. So this is an email from Travis, and he has a question about enhancing his Civ 5 game. I have recently started playing on Emperor difficulty, and I can pull off scientific victories pretty easily, but I can't take a domination game. I will give a specific example. My most recent game was as Arabia, 8 players, Pangaea, standard speed, default settings. Okay, fairly standard. I started in the Far East, and Hiawatha started in the Far West. Moving from my position to the west, there was Gondi, mountain range, Netherlands, then Dido, Hiawatha. Persia was off to the north. Monty and Spain were also hanging out north of Hiawatha. So he set to war almost immediately, only expanding once, and then taking India with composite bows and horsemen. Okay, so early war, good. In this time, the Netherlands were almost completely wiped out by its neighbors. He got his camel archers and went north to Persia. And he thinks that this diversion cost him the game, but Persia had 10 wonders in his capital.
Really shiny. Yeah.
Hey, you got shinies. I'll take those. That's never a bad diversion.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say.
No, not unless you fail.
Yeah, exactly. After taking the capital, he built and filled universities in all his non-puppeted cities. And then he took a city-state out and one of the Netherlands' last cities, which was on the way to Dido and Hiawatha. So far, it sounds generally okay. He upgraded to artillery and cavalry and took out Dido. Okay, well, there's your problem right there. Upgrading camel archers to cavalry. going from a 3-range, 2-attack per turn unit, once properly promoted, to a melee unit that can't use any of those promotions. I mean, at some point you do have to upgrade, but I generally don't upgrade my camel archers to cavalry, mostly because you're now wasting all those promotions.
Yeah.
And 3-range logistics units, even if they're only doing a couple points of damage, are still doing a couple points of damage versus the cavalry, which won't be able to help that well. Otherwise, he had a 24-pop capital with a national college, as well as full universities, and he's getting public schools in most of his cities at that point. He had about 400 beakers per turn, but Hiawatha was about 14 techs ahead, and the combined efforts of himself and Monty could not stop him from getting to a scientific victory. His Great War bombers would literally just explode on his 150 defense border cities. So this is obviously a very late game.
Yeah.
When he finally upgraded to artillery and cavalry and tried to take on Hiawatha. He suggests that he should not have gone bombers, but Hiawatha didn't seem to have any planes, and Arabia, of course, gets the double oil, so it does sound like a great plan. Last thing he says is that he did only expand once, but annexed any decent city that he took over because he had so much cash as Arabia. He could easily buy courthouses and other buildings.
That might be a
bit of an issue because you don't necessarily need to annex every single city.
Mm-hmm. You just need cash to buy units.
Exactly. That
in a city that has the infrastructure for the experience.
Exactly. So social policy-wise, he did go tradition, honor with legalism, landed elite, and full honor track before taking the center column of order, which leads towards the extra science from factories and reduced cost of buildings and everything else along that line. It's not a bad place. Now, if he said he went autocracy and failed hard, well, that's because you went autocracy. But he did go order, so it was a good plan. So he says, when he goes for domination, he always seems to be kingmaker instead of king. This particular game, he thinks Hiawatha got a little lucky that Monty absorbed Spain before turning his eyes to the city, spamming Iroquois. But this issue does happen every time. And he'd be happy to answer any further questions or even call in on the show. So anyways, what do you guys think about that?
Well, I think we already covered number one. You shouldn't have annexed all those cities.
That is true.
Became a larger thing, too. That probably slowed the war down a bit.
Well, camel archers are really good for trashing everything.
I mean, upgrading them to cavalry, like you mentioned earlier. It sounds to me just like these wars early on took too long relative to his tech rate. Because this can happen in any Civ game if you're conquering, but you're not keeping up in tech. Eventually, you can get to the point where you just can't take someone out because they're too far ahead of you.
Well, for the 150 defense border cities, artillery is a little better than bombers or great war bombers when it comes to that, because you're not taking damage. Even if you're not doing as much damage as you possibly could, your artillery is not going to get hit.
So you just have to clear out anything that can kill your arty really easily.
And of course, as always with bombers, pay attention when you're using them.
Don't send a red-lined bomber in on that 150 defense city.
And get to air repair as fast as you possibly can and set down a unit that has medic next to it. And therefore, the air repair will get medic boosted.
Ooh.
I mean, bombers tend to be the way to go because, hey, bombers.
One unit per hex? Not anymore.
Nine units in this hex.
Yeah. But volume of bombers would probably do better. So as the main team was already stating, not spending all that money on annexing all the cities and courthouses and actually spending on units probably would have been a better plan.
Especially because those units would have been available to kill Hiawatha sooner, and maybe he would not have had 14 tech lead at that point.
Well, Hiawatha is one of those super spammers.
Yeah.
He can get away with a lot of stuff in the early game, especially if none of his AI neighbors were slowing him down.
Yeah. Even in vanilla, he was probably one of the stronger AIs, if you're talking about like how the computer plays the Civ.
One thing we are missing, though, is turn times from this email. So we don't know, he was pulling in 450 beakers, but is that at like turn 250? Was it at, you know, was Hiawatha getting to like the Snowball Empire, where even the Emperor AI can get to a turn 250 to 300 space race win? Or was this like after turn 300? Was it after turn 400?
Yeah.
So we don't know where approximately that comes in.
Yeah, out of context, beaker values are really difficult to read. As you know, if you're pulling in 450 beakers, you know, in the early ADs, you're doing pretty well, but if you're doing that in like the 1900s, not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're doing mass conquests, you're not...
Oh, yeah, it barely matters. As long as you have enough to kill people, it really doesn't matter. Get some research agreements and some stompage.
He did say he was getting universities and all the tech buildings into his cities. So that's obviously a good thing, because when you're trying to dominate, you still need universities and public schools and all that.
Unless you can get techs by capturing cities.
That's later.
Not sure that they should bother with universities and whatnot. They have their own economy.
Yeah. We'll just take yours. There you go. No, but it does sound like his plan was generally okay. Taking out India with combs of bows and horsemen. Sure. Yeah. That's a good start. Horsemen are great because Gandhi gets his stupid war elephants. So using horsemen to run in and smash them up so that Composabos can clean up cities and stuff like that. That's sufficient, because you're also going to see a lot less spear units wandering around with Gandhi. So that's a good choice. Dutch getting wiped out by his neighbors, but he moved into camel archers. That, and yes, as Arabia, if you're going to go fighting, camel archers are absolutely the best unit to do it with in the medieval to industrial era. They're far better than Keshiks once you get the range and logistics going, because they have higher combat strength and higher range damage. They're just slightly slower, but realistically that matters nothing if you're just twitching back and forth shooting at a city. Yeah, without the context of timeline, it sounds like how he was going through was okay, maybe just not fast enough.
Yeah, it might just be a pure micro thing.
Yeah, if he was able to get to camel archers like before turn 100, he would have probably been able to use them for another 100 turns, no problem.
Yeah.
Now, of course, how fast Hiawatha got away with mass spam.
It's not. Is also well, he for, could have gone for Hiawatha earlier by the sound.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, choosing your targets wisely is probably a very important thing. If you do have a runaway,
yeah,
you probably should go try and stop it sooner than later.
The only time that's really difficult are on continents maps where you just meet the other continent and it's already one civ.
Yes, that is a bit harder.
Hopefully they have a coastal capital, because that's a very fun way to win domination.
So it sounds like start position might have been a thing in here.
Started by Alex the Great, and he was saying that he is sick of being screwed over by starting position. Basically, he would get no strategic resources near his cities, but the other civs would have, like, everything. I noticed that more in Civ 4 than Civ 5, but also in this thread it was mentioned to use strategic balance. It'll guarantee you horses and iron near, if not in, your city's radius. And I did a little test of that earlier where I started a couple games just doing strategic balance, and I did get horses in my range. And I hadn't gotten to iron, so I don't know if I had iron or not, but I definitely had horses, and that's good.
I hadn't really thought about the strategic balance setting. I guess it's sort of like the quote-unquote balanced resources in Civ 4,
yeah.
Which was a joke, but at least you did get access to some strategic resources that way. One thing that I just don't understand in Civ is why that isn't the default option, where you have access to some reasonable amount of resources in every capital, or close enough. It is a little bit ridiculous how, if you're sufficiently unlucky, you can just be screwed over. That it's less bad in Civ 5. So I'm glad that they made it less asinine, but it can still be pretty rough.
I've never had a problem in Civ 5, really. I mean, I've had some bad starting positions, but I mean, certainly nothing next to the brutal stuff you'd get in Civ 3 or Civ 4. And I've always liked, you know, the challenge of trying to compensate for those little shortages. Now, if I'm a unique Civ, I've got a Civ unique unit that requires horses, and I don't have horses, yeah, that really, really pisses me off. And then I'm doubly neutered. And same thing.
Big
world. Yeah, and same thing with iron, you know. I mean, but then again, you know, I remember playing Civ games where iron comes up, and I realize, oh, crap, I have iron working before Augustus does. I see he has iron. That gives me a strategic reason to go after him now. Because since I play strategy games mostly for the feeling of building a history, building a story, the narrative, the tales that I can tell coming out of it, the shortages really don't bother me all that much. I'm not trying to min-max my game to get up to the top of to master deity level. I'm trying to create really nice, fun experiences. So it doesn't bother me all that much in Civ 5 because it is much more balanced. But I remember, you know, Civ 3 games, congratulations, you're starting in a jungle. Have fun. On an island. It's like, oh, crap. This is the worst
part
of the map. Yeah, well, yes. And it's like, okay.
And start.
I mean, does anybody ever play those through? I mean,
yeah.
Some people do, and some people actually win doing that. But that's not a lot of fun for me. But I've never noticed it to be a huge problem in Civ 5. But I can see it if it annoys some people and there's a mod to fix it. Just, you know, go with the mod.
I think they've come a long way in this regard, and that you're right. It is not as bad in Civ 5. You can still get screwed, though. Like, say you spawn next to one of those city spammer AIs on a reasonably high difficulty, and you're limited by really not only strategics, but also luxuries. Like, you only get one or two luxuries, so you're locked into it, like a tundra-type area, and there just isn't good land nearby, and you're walled. Like, you literally get walled off by the AI pretty darn quickly. So I guess you could try a run-by and, like, settle, like, across the continent through enemy territory or something, but it's a tough spot to play at.
If you're at an advanced difficulty level, then, you know, that's one of the problems with an advanced difficulty level.
The other problem is if you're not on an advanced difficulty level and you're someone who can win on advanced difficulty levels normally, if you're not playing there, you can just, like, warrior and archer rush things to death. It's not even hard.
Right.
So I don't know.
But I'm not afraid, you know, start over. So, okay, I'm going to lose this game. I quit. You win AI. I'll start over. But, you know, bad map situations in Civ 5 have rarely been an issue for me. Maybe I'm just not playing at a high enough level where it bothers me all that much.
I've only seen it a few times. It's pretty rare now.
If you have a unique that needs a resource, like, I mean, Rome in vanilla was the ultimate. If you made it all the way to ironworking, which was a really long path, doesn't matter your difficulty level. Yeah. If you made it there and there was not a single point of iron on the entire map that you could find.
That was pretty much a restart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a huge waste of time to go find it out, too. So, yes, people do get really cranky about that sort of thing. But, I mean, realistically, the only things you should count on are two versions of one luxury and one version of a different luxury, because that's what's supposed to be what you start with, give or take. Sometimes it's a little adjusted. And then strategic resources are maybe here, maybe there. You need to go get them. You shouldn't just be dropping one city and expecting to get everything.
Exactly.
Because, you need to go that
out.
Happens.
You need to go out, explore, conquer, trade, do all the things that a civilization's supposed to do.
Yeah, but we're talking like 15 to 20 hexes or more away here, not like, oh, I can just settle for this now that I've taxed it.
Yeah, it's one thing if I'm on a large island or a small continent or something and the iron's on the other side, that's okay. It's when the whole continent is no iron, no this, no that. This game sucks.
Yeah.
That's more balance in the scripts that actually create the world, not necessarily balance.
Yeah, it's not a starting position thing anymore then.
Though there is a specific file or two about starting positions for how they actually balance the starting positions, because they do actually give each starting position a certain weight and value based on what's around it. And strategic resources do count very heavily in those as well. And so therefore you can get starts where it has great value, but you settle and there's no luxuries around. But hey, when you get to the information age, you'll find out that you have a ton of uranium.
Yes.
They should just weight the early game stuff way, way more. Like that would be such a simple thing. If you need medieval or later text to unlock it, don't make it a serious factor in weighting starting positions.
I think there is a bit of that. Plus, the starting positions are decided after the map is made.
Yeah.
And that becomes another problem, because if the map is not reasonably balanced by the time it's picking start positions, then obviously you have another problem.
Just have it throw down an extra couple resources on weak spots.
Yeah, I mean, they do have the code to be able to adjust things and everything else. But
they did that in Civ 4, but the waiting algorithm was just so horrible that it didn't help. But, you know, they had this idea. They had a good idea with it in Civ 4 already, aside from just spawn positions, literally. Like, who could possibly expand into X amount of land? You get a lot of situations where some one person spawned in the middle of a continent and the other one spawned at the edge of the continent and there's no one on the other edge. So the guy who spawns in the middle just, you know, insta-wins. And if that's an AI... Oh my god, it's like the worst continent to meet ever later. Can still happen in Civ 5, but land is so poorly expanded slash taken, typically, unless you have a runaway warmonger, that it's really not the same issue that it once was.
I guess for the thread, the way they basically came out to it is some starting locations suck.
Yeah.
But eventually you need to address this through your gameplay. I always loathe never having coal. This is from Cicerosaurus. And usually next to no iron, no matter how wide I went, they seem to cover half the map and still lack some. So instead of I have gone the other way and just sold a few cities, that's the most love approach here. Of course, you have fewer resources, but I found that you're able to create more wealth to gain those resources through allying city-states or trading with the enemy, so to speak. Someone will always have an excess of something you can trade for a price. Make sure you sell all your excess luxuries to obtain the gold and then go get the other stuff.
And that's a very reasonable approach.
Yeah. A very, very old game back in Villa that I did was with Monty. I had no iron. But hey, almost every single city state in the neighborhood had iron. And the only way to really get iron was to ally a city state.
I was going to say, I wonder what happened to those city states.
Actually, they stayed my allies. I wasn't slaughtering city states back then.
Yeah, it's easier, I think, to trade, I've found, with the city states than with the actual AI that just does not want to be your friend for any reason.
Oh, that's not true.
And I just have a really difficult time with them.
Just stop telling them to go away. Stop taking their land.
But that's what the city states are there for, right? I mean, they're there for
your capital is their land,
so.
But yes, actually, I think in the scripts, city-states are meant to get a monopoly of something. So that multiple city-states either get the same luxury, so that it's spread around, so that people can ally up a city-state and get the luxury. Sometimes I've definitely found it's strategic resources, where city-states all happen to have all of the strategic resources of one type. Coal seems to pop up like that a lot.
Ugh.
So there are different ways to get the things that you do not start with. But yes, it is, back to the beginning of the topic, very frustrating when you have a unique something and you can't go get it yourself. And many people are a little more cranky about that. But you can definitely go with strategic balance.
Looks like next up we are going wide. LOL. thread started by Black Knight 1239. Basically, his question or his thread is, so I'm struggling to break through the jump to Emperor, and so I've been looking at a ton of different strategies to help me through it. I've been really interested in going with a wide Emperor, setting up a strong economy and a shot at 3 of 4 victory conditions, but I'm having trouble finding advice that isn't based around ICS. That's interesting, actually, but okay. at the moment, I'm able to hit about turn 60 with 4 cities, all with luxury resources grabbed when I settle. It should be, I'm not sure what to do after that. Go in war to grab a few more cities, or maybe keep settling every time I can afford to, even if there isn't a luxury resource in the area. No. Wait to get to the NC, or then keep going. I'm trying a lot of Arabia and Maya, though I haven't played half these guys yet, and I'm willing to try anything interesting. Any tips?
Can we define what ICS is for those who don't know what that means?
Infinite City Sprawl. Okay. And I have not seen too many strategy and tips threads advocating Infinite City Sprawl in a long time. Like, pre-patch vanilla, it was probably the strongest thing you could do, but we're not in pre-patch vanilla anymore, and even in vanilla now, it's not the strongest thing you can do. So I don't know.
It does seem like it's stronger to be smaller cities in this game because of all the national wonder stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And if you go on strategy and tips for Civ 5, that 4-city opener is still a major thread there with so many responses. And it is one of the stronger openers. And if you're looking for something canned that doesn't apply strategy of your own too much, that's probably a good place to start. And when you go beyond that, I guess just depends on game situation. But I have a question. Okay, so say you want to just spam the heck out of cities. How would you develop them in order to allow you to spam more cities quickly?
Low and easy.
No, I mean, like, on a decent difficulty level here. Not a difficulty level where you can kill everything with just horsemen and win instantly.
No, I was talking about the population of the cities. Keep the populations low so that you're not chewing up happiness. You can easily get up to 5 to 8, depending on what happiness buildings you have available. Definitely you can get all the basic buildings into every single city, but you're not going to want to put in all the big stuff. Like, after universities, you probably don't want to put public schools or anything big in those cities.
Let's define the basic buildings then for everybody.
Libraries.
Okay.
Markets.
Granary.
Yes, because you're going to run specialists. Watermill, if you happen to have it. The shrines, temples, monuments, that sort of stuff.
There you go. All right.
Workshops.
And then you just keep them small.
Basically, you want, for the more ICS-y style, you want to get your per-city happiness bonuses, i.e. meritocracy, opener of order, and even some religion, to give you that +1 global happiness per city. And that takes care of the 3 unhappiness per city. And then after that, you're just worried about how much population local happiness bonuses you can get. So, you know, once you have your coliseums and theaters and pagodas for religion.
I've never been able to match the 4-city opener with that.
It's not quite the same anymore.
Yeah, I guess. I haven't done like any Gods and Kings, so I could be wrong now.
No, even in Gods and Kings, 4-city tradition build is pretty strong. It's fairly strong. And the ICS thing, yeah, I mean, you can see it on the Mayan with the Messenger of the Gods. If you have Mayans with Messenger of the Gods, because you're going to get science from their building, you're going to get science from the...
The Mayans get science from breathing.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Spam cities as tightly as possible so you can pack them all in. And you're going to get a crazy amount of science. In which case, provided you have the space to do that, you will actually get quite a lot of science, because 2 science from Messenger of the God is worth a 4-pop city that has a library. The library from the 4-pop city anyways, or 3 technically due to rounding. So yeah, you can super pump experience. And while you're doing it, especially as a Mayans, you build your little Atlas, the archer replacement, you build those, make them all composite bows, and then you just kind of roll. forward, burning down everything in your path. Even on higher difficulty levels, you can get away with that. It just depends on how much space you have. And of course, you're going Liberty.
Yeah.
You can do stuff like that as Rome and certain other civs, but you really want to do it only with civs that have bonuses to going wide. ICS in general with any civ is definitely not as powerful as just going like four city tradition opener or going out to like 6 to 7 cities and going tall from there.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
The most important aspect that was shown over in the PAX East demo, and which spawned quite a few threads about this was a joke.
For Brave New World, we wanted to make sure that our combat chains were complete and that we really hadn't missed out on anything. And one thing that we were missing was we have this World War II paratrooper, but it'd be kind of nice to have a paratrooper that was a little more modern than that, that maybe could play with giant death robots and have some fun with that. So Dennis is going to show you how the XCOM squad works. And let's go ahead and give him a paratrooper.
Yes, you two can fight the aliens that are apparently running Assyria. Hey, they had a GDR, man. That's clearly a sectopod. Oh, apparently there is a new Axeman unit. Mm-hmm. Possibly barbarian or maybe a new unique unit is still the question mark. It did show up as a barbarian unit in a particular screenshot. I just wanted to mention it because it has gotten like 8 or 9 pages worth of discussion.
Really? An Axeman unit? Okay.
So yes, it's actually got 10 pages now worth of discussion. There was a picture of Assyria. There was an Axeman barbarian there with a swordsman next to it. And the swordsman was hurt, but the barbarian was not. So that has led to many old questions on, is it a new barbarian unit? Is it a new unique unit that they actually claimed to be barbarian in the screenshot? Because we all know this set them up. And they just wanted to mess with us. Seriously, 10 pages worth of that. Close-up screenshots. It's a new Native American unique unit, but pretending to be a barbarian because they've got mohawks.
Uh-huh. We're getting a
would like to point out the mohawks are already part of the...
Yeah, the Iroquois already there. Maybe it's Sumerian? I can dream. Mm. Sumerian's coming back.
Well, we have the Assyrians.
Yeah.
So, you know, Babylon's going to be surrounded.
So this is time to wrap up the show. This has been Podcast 170 with Majin.
Good times, good times. Next,
Macalula.
And
the mean team.
Toodles.
And Troy.
Glad I could be here.
And myself, Alpha Shard. Thanks for listening.
Except multitask. I don't understand why. You don't have your coffee machine and your computer and your bed all in close proximity. It just doesn't make sense.
I can get two of those in close proximity. I don't think the coffee machine being in the same room would be good, though.
No, you just have a little separate table for it. It's all a question of priority. And if you stagger these things properly, it would be a great setup. Basically, you have the computer in the middle, the coffee on the other side, and then the bed on the other side of the computer. So the computer's between the coffee and the bed.
Makalua?
Hi, everybody!
You sound quite like the gingerbread man from Shrek. That's quite impressive.
Speaking about potential disasters...
Boop, doo, boop.
Oh! Hey, everybody!
Oh.
Oh, blooper reel. I muted myself. They could hear you.
can't hear me. I wonder why.
Great.
Yeah, you're going to have to bear with us here. Dan handled most of the technical stuff, and there's a lot of nuances to the software, apparently, that you don't just know without having experience or being told, and there's too many of them to tell, so we're working through that.
Randomly, that was an XSplit issue, and Dan doesn't use it, so that was my own fault.
No, we are blaming Dan's absence.
Tourism being the new cultural offense-related yield for brain just not working. Dan does this so much better. Apparently they are fire and forget style, or at least that's what it looked like.
That's not what happened in Call of Duty. Call of Duty.
Said, it's not Call of Duty, Trade Roots.
Commando.
I don't even play that game. What the hell?
We're diverging from Dan's plan on making us actually talk about stuff to...
Record date April 6, 2013. PAX East sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.